White Fang, Disc 4.
Kiche licked White Fang soothingly with her tongue and tried to prevail upon him to remain with her. But his curiosity was rampant, and several minutes later he was venturing forth on a new quest. He came upon one of the man-animals, Gray Beaver, who was squatting on his hams and doing something with sticks and dry moss spread before him on the ground. White Fang came near to him and watched. Gray Beaver made mouth noises which White Fang interpreted as not hostile, so he came still nearer. Women and children were carrying more sticks and branches to Gray Beaver. It was evidently an affair of moment. White Fang came in until he touched Gray Beaver's knee, so curious was he, and already forgetful that this was a terrible man-animal. Suddenly, he saw a strange thing like mist beginning to arise from the sticks and moss beneath Gray Beaver's hands. Then, amongst the sticks themselves, appeared a live thing, twisting and turning, of a color like the color of the sun in the sky. White Fang knew nothing about fire. It drew him as the light in the mouth of the cave had drawn him in his early puppyhood. He crawled the several steps toward the flame. He heard Gray Beaver chuckle above him, and he knew the sound was not hostile. Then his nose touched the flame, and at the same instant his little tongue went out to it. For a moment he was paralyzed. The unknown, lurking in the midst of the sticks and moss, was savagely clutching him by the nose. He scrambled backward, bursting out in an astonished explosion of ki-yis. At the sound, Kiche leaped snarling to the end of her stick, and there raged terribly because she couldn't come to his aid. But Gray Beaver laughed loudly and slapped his thighs and told the happening to all the rest of the camp, till everybody was laughing uproariously. But White Fang sat on his haunches and ki-yied and ki-yied, a forlorn and pitiable little figure in the midst of the man-animals. It was the worst hurt he had ever known. Both nose and tongue had been scorched by the live thing, sun-colored, that had grown up under Gray Beaver's hands. He cried and cried interminably, and every fresh wail was greeted by bursts of laughter on the part of the man-animals. He tried to soothe his nose with his tongue, but the tongue was burned too, and the two hurts coming together produced greater hurt, whereupon he cried more hopelessly and helplessly than ever. And then shame came to him. He knew laughter and the meaning of it. It's not given to us to know how some animals know laughter, and know when they are being laughed at. But it was this same way that White Fang knew it. And he felt shame that the man-animals should be laughing at him. He turned and fled away, not from the hurt of the fire, but from the laughter that sank even deeper and hurt in the spirit of him. And he fled to Kiche, raging at the end of her stick like an animal gone mad. To Kiche, the one creature in the world who wasn't laughing at him. Twilight drew down, and night came on. And White Fang lay by his mother's side. His nose and tongue still hurt, but he was perplexed by a greater trouble. He was homesick. He felt a vacancy in him, a need for the hush and quietude of the stream and the cave in the cliff. Life had become too populous. There were so many of the man-animals, men, women, and children, all making noises and irritations. And there were the dogs, ever squabbling and bickering, bursting into uproars and creating confusions. The restful loneliness of the only life he had known was gone. Here the very air was palpitant with life. It hummed and buzzed unceasingly, continually changing its intensity, and abruptly variant in pitch, it impinged on his nerves and senses, made him nervous and restless, and worried him with a perpetual imminence of happening. He watched the man-animals coming and going and moving about the camp, in fashion distantly resembling the way men look upon the gods they create. So looked White Fang upon the man-animals before him. They were superior creatures of a verity, gods. To his dim comprehension, they were as much wonder-workers as gods are to men. They were creatures of mastery, possessing all manner of unknown and impossible potencies, overlords of the alive and the not alive, making obey that which moved, imparting movement to that which did not move, and making life, sun-colored and biting life, to grow out of dead moss and wood. They were fire-makers. They were gods. Chapter 10. The Bondage. The days were thronged with experience for White Fang. During the time that K'iche was tied by the stick, he ran about over all the camp, inquiring, investigating, learning. He quickly came to know much of the ways of the man-animals, but familiarity didn't breed contempt. The more he came to know them, the more they vindicated their superiority, the more they displayed their mysterious powers, the greater loomed their godlikeness. To man has been given the grief, often, of seeing his gods overthrown and his altars crumbling. But to the wolf and the wild dog that have come in to crouch at man's feet, this grief has never come. Unlike man, whose gods are of the unseen and the overguessed, vapors and mists of fancy eluding the garmenture of reality, wandering wraiths of desired goodness and power, intangible outcroppings of self into the realm of spirit. Unlike man, the wolf and the wild dog that have come into their fire find their gods in the living flesh, solid to the touch, occupying earth space and requiring time for the accomplishment of their ends and their existence. No effort of faith is necessary to believe in such a god. No effort of will can possibly induce disbelief in such a god. There's no getting away from it. There it stands, on its two hind legs, club in hand, immensely potential, passionate and wrathful and loving, God and mystery and power, all wrapped up and around by flesh that bleeds when it's torn and that is good to eat like any flesh. And so it was with White Fang. The man-animals were gods, unmistakable and unescapable. As his mother, K'iche, had rendered her allegiance to them at the first cry of her name, so he was beginning to render his allegiance. He gave them the trail as a privilege indubitably theirs. When they walked, he got out of their way. When they called, he came. When they threatened, he cowered down. When they commanded him to go, he went away hurriedly, for behind any wish of theirs was power to enforce that wish, power that hurt, power that expressed itself in clouts and clubs, in flying stones and stinging lashes of whips. He belonged to them as all dogs belonged to them. His actions were theirs to command. His body was theirs to maul, to stamp upon, to tolerate. Such was the lesson that was quickly borne in upon him. It came hard, going, as it did, counter to much that was strong and dominant in his own nature. And while he disliked it in the learning of it, unknown to himself, he was learning to like it. It was a placing of his destiny in another's hands, a shifting of the responsibilities of existence. This in itself was compensation, for it's always easier to lean upon another than to stand alone. But it didn't all happen in a day, this giving over of himself, body and soul, to the man-animals. He couldn't immediately forego his wild heritage and his memories of the wild. There were days when he crept to the edge of the forest and stood and listened to something calling him far and away. And always he returned, restless and uncomfortable, to whimper softly and wistfully at Kiche's side, and to lick her face with eager, questioning tongue. White Fang learned rapidly the ways of the camp. He knew the injustice and greediness of the older dogs when meat or fish was thrown out to be eaten. He came to know that men were more just, children more cruel, and women more kindly and more likely to toss him a bit of meat or bone. And after two or three painful adventures with the mothers of part-grown puppies, he came into the knowledge that it was always good policy to let such mothers alone, to keep away from them as far as possible, and to avoid them when he saw them coming. But the bane of his life was Lip Lip. Larger, older, and stronger, Lip Lip had selected White Fang for his special object of persecution. White Fang fought willingly enough, but he was outclassed. His enemy was too big. Lip Lip became a nightmare to him. Whenever he ventured away from his mother, the bully was sure to appear, trailing at his heels, snarling at him, picking upon him, and watchful of an opportunity when no man-animal was near to spring upon him and force a fight. As Lip Lip invariably won, he enjoyed it hugely. It became his chief delight in life, as it became White Fang's chief torment. But the effect upon White Fang was not to cow him. Though he suffered most of the damage and was always defeated, his spirit remained unsubdued. Yet a bad effect was produced. He became malignant and morose. His temper had been savage by birth, but it became more savage under this unending persecution. The genial, playful, puppyish side of him found little expression. He never played and gambled about with the other puppies of the camp. Lip Lip wouldn't permit it. The moment White Fang appeared near them, Lip Lip was upon him, bullying and hectoring him, or fighting with him until he'd driven him away. The effect of all this was to rob White Fang of much of his puppyhood, and to make him, in his comportment, older than his age. Denied the outlet through play of his energies, he recoiled upon himself and developed his mental processes. He became cunning. He had idle time in which to devote himself to thoughts of trickery. Prevented from obtaining his share of meat and fish when a general feed was given to the camp dogs, he became a clever thief. He had to forage for himself, and he foraged well, though he was oft-times a plague to the squaws in consequence. He learned to sneak about camp, to be crafty, to know what was going on everywhere, to see and to hear everything, and to reason accordingly, and successfully to devise ways and means of avoiding his implacable persecutor. It was in the early days of his persecution that he played his first really big, crafty game, and got therefrom his first taste of revenge. As Quiche, when with the wolves, had lured out to destruction dogs from the camps of men, so White Fang, in manner somewhat similar, lured Lip-Lip into Quiche's avenging jaws. Retreating before Lip-Lip, White Fang made an indirect flight that led in and out and around the various teepees of the camp. He was a good runner, swifter than any other puppy of his size, and swifter than Lip-Lip. But he didn't run his best in this chase. He barely held his own, one leap ahead of his pursuer. Lip-Lip, excited by the chase and by the persistent nearness of his victim, forgot caution and locality. When he remembered locality, it was too late. Dashing at top speed around a teepee, he ran full tilt into Quiche, lying at the end of her stick. He gave one yelp of consternation, and then her punishing jaws closed upon him. She was tied, but he couldn't get away from her easily. She rolled him off his legs so that he couldn't run, while she repeatedly ripped and slashed him with her fangs. When at last he succeeded in rolling clear of her, he crawled to his feet, badly disheveled, hurt both in body and in spirit. His hair was standing out all over him in tufts where her teeth had mauled. He stood where he'd arisen, opened his mouth, and broke out the long, heartbroken puppy wail. But even this he wasn't allowed to complete. In the middle of it, White Fang, rushing in, sank his teeth into Lip-Lip's hind leg. There was no fight left in Lip-Lip, and he ran away shamelessly, his victim hot on his heels and worrying him all the way back to his own teepee. Here the squaws came to his aid, and White Fang, transformed into a raging demon, was finally driven off only by a fusillade of stones. Came the day when Grey Beaver, deciding that the liability of her running away was past, released Quiche. White Fang was delighted with his mother's freedom. He accompanied her joyfully about the camp, and so long as he remained close by her side, Lip-Lip kept a respectful distance. White Fang even bristled up to him and walked stiff-legged. But Lip-Lip ignored the challenge. He was no fool himself, and whatever vengeance he desired to wreak, he could wait until he caught White Fang alone. Later on that day, Quiche and White Fang strayed into the edge of the woods next to the camp. He had led his mother there step by step, and now, when she stopped, he tried to inveigle her farther. The stream, the lair, and the quiet woods were calling to him, and he wanted her to come. He ran on a few steps, stopped, and looked back. She'd not moved. He whined pleadingly and scurried playfully in and out of the underbrush. He ran back to her, licked her face, and ran on again. And still she didn't move. He stopped and regarded her, all of an intentness and eagerness, physically expressed, that slowly faded out of him as she turned her head and gazed back at the camp. There was something calling to him out there in the open. His mother heard it too, but she heard also that other and louder call, the call of the fire and of man, the call which it has been given alone of all animals to the wolf to answer, to the wolf and the wild dog, who are brothers. Quiche turned and slowly trotted back toward camp. Stronger than the physical restraint of the stick was the clutch of the camp upon her. Unseen and occultly, the god still gripped with their power and wouldn't let her go. White Fang sat down in the shadow of a birch and whimpered softly. There was a strong smell of pine, and subtle woods fragrances filled the air, reminding him of his own life of freedom before the days of his bondage. But he was still only a part-grown puppy, and stronger than the call either of man or of the wild was the call of his mother. All the hours of his short life he depended upon her. The time was yet to come for independence. So he arose and trotted forlornly back to camp, pausing once and twice to sit down and whimper and to listen to the call that still sounded in the depths of the forest. In the wild, the time of a mother with her young is short, but under the domination of man, it's sometimes even shorter. Thus it was with White Fang. Grey Beaver was in the debt of Three Eagles. Three Eagles was going away on a trip up the Mackenzie to the Great Slave Lake. A strip of scarlet cloth, a bearskin, 20 cartridges, and Quiche went to pay the debt. White Fang saw his mother taken aboard Three Eagles' canoe and tried to follow her. A blow from Three Eagles knocked him backward to the land. The canoe shoved off. He sprang into the water and swam after it, deaf to the sharp cries of Grey Beaver to return. Even a man-animal, a god, White Fang ignored. Such was the terror he was in of losing his mother. But gods are accustomed to being obeyed, and Grey Beaver wrathfully launched a canoe in pursuit. When he overtook White Fang, he reached down and by the nape of the neck lifted him clear of the water. He didn't deposit him at once in the bottom of the canoe. Holding him suspended with one hand, with the other hand he proceeded to give him a beating. And it was a beating. His hand was heavy. Every blow was shrewd to hurt. And he delivered a multitude of blows. Impelled by the blows that rained upon him, now from this side, now from that, White Fang swung back and forth like an erratic and jerky pendulum. Varying were the emotions that surged through him. At first, he'd known surprise. Then came a momentary fear, when he yelped several times to the impact of the hand. But this was quickly followed by anger. His free nature asserted itself, and he showed his teeth and snarled fearlessly in the face of the wrathful god. This but served to make the god more wrathful. The blows came faster, heavier, more shrewd to hurt. Grey Beaver continued to beat. White Fang continued to snarl. But this couldn't last forever. One or the other must give over, and that one was White Fang. Fear surged through him again. For the first time, he was really being manhandled. The occasional blows of sticks and stones he'd previously experienced were as caresses compared with this. He broke down and began to cry and yelp. For a time, each blow brought a yelp from him. But fear passed into terror, until finally his yelps were voiced in unbroken succession, unconnected with the rhythm of the punishment. At last, Grey Beaver withheld his hand. White Fang, hanging limply, continued to cry. This seemed to satisfy the master, who flung him down roughly in the bottom of the canoe. In the meantime, the canoe had drifted down the stream. Grey Beaver picked up the paddle. White Fang was in his way. He spurned him savagely with his foot. In that moment, White Fang's free nature flashed forth again, and he sunk his teeth into the moccasined foot. the beating that had gone before was as nothing compared with the beating he now received. Grey Beaver's wrath was terrible. Likewise was White Fang's fright. Not only the hand, but the hard wooden paddle was used upon him, and he was bruised and sore in all his small body when he was again flung down in the canoe. Again, and this time with purpose, did Grey Beaver kick him. White Fang didn't repeat his attack on the foot. He'd learned another lesson of his bondage. Never, no matter what the circumstance, must he dare to bite the god who was lord and master over him. The body of the lord and master was sacred, not to be defiled by the teeth of such as he. That was evidently the crime of crimes, the one offense there was no condoning nor overlooking. When the canoe touched the shore, White Fang lay whimpering and motionless, waiting the will of Grey Beaver. It was Grey Beaver's will that he should go ashore, for ashore he was flung, striking heavily on his side and hurting his bruises afresh. He crawled tremblingly to his feet and stood whimpering. Lip Lip, who'd watched the whole proceedings from the bank, now rushed upon him, knocking him over and sinking his teeth into him. White Fang was too helpless to defend himself, and it would have gone hard with him had not Grey Beaver's foot shot out, lifting Lip Lip into the air with its violence, so that he smashed down to earth a dozen feet away. This was the man animal's justice. And even then, in his own pitiable plight, White Fang experienced a little grateful thrill. At Grey Beaver's heels, he limped obediently through the village to the teepee. And so it came that White Fang learned that the right to punish was something the gods reserved for themselves and denied to the lesser creatures under them. That night, when all was still, White Fang remembered his mother and sorrowed for her. He sorrowed too loudly and woke up Grey Beaver, who beat him. After that, he mourned gently when the gods were around. But sometimes, straying off to the edge of the woods by himself, he gave vent to his grief and cried it with loud whimperings and wailings. It was during this period that he might have hearkened to the memories of the lair and the stream and run back into the wild. But the memory of his mother held him. As the hunting man-animals went out and came back, so she would come back to the village sometime. So he remained in his bondage, waiting for her. But it wasn't altogether an unhappy bondage. There was much to interest him. Something was always happening. There was no end to the strange things these gods did, and he was always curious to see. Besides, he was learning how to get along with Grey Beaver. Obedience. Rigid, undeviating obedience was what was expected of him. And in return, he escaped beatings, and his existence was tolerated. Nay, Grey Beaver himself sometimes tossed him a piece of meat and defended him against the other dogs in the eating of it. And such a piece of meat was of value. It was worth more in some strange way than a dozen pieces of meat from the hand of a squaw. Grey Beaver never petted nor caressed. Perhaps it was the weight of his hand, and perhaps his justice, perhaps the sheer power of him, and perhaps it was all of these things that influenced White Fang. For a certain tie of attachment was forming between him and his surly lord. Insidiously, and by remote ways, as well as by the power of stick and stone and clout of hand, were the shackles of White Fang's bondage being riveted upon him. the qualities in his kind that in the beginning made it possible for them to come into the fires of men were qualities capable of development. They were developing in him. And the camp life, replete with misery as it was secretly endearing itself to him all the time. But White Fang was unaware of it. He knew only grief for the loss of K'iche, hope for her return, and a hungry yearning for the free life that had been his. Chapter 11. The Outcast. Lip-Lip continued so to darken his days that White Fang became wickeder and more ferocious than it was his natural right to be. Savageness was a part of his makeup, but the savageness thus developed exceeded his makeup. He acquired a reputation for wickedness amongst the man-animals themselves. Wherever there was trouble and uproar in camp, fighting and squabbling, or the outcry of a squaw over a bit of stolen meat, they were sure to find White Fang mixed up in it, and usually at the bottom of it. They didn't bother to look after the causes of his conduct. They saw only the effects, and the effects were bad. He was a sneak and a thief, a mischief-maker, a fomenter of trouble. And irate squaws told him to his face, the while he eyed them alert and ready to dodge any quick-flung missile, that he was a wolf and worthless and bound to come to an evil end. He found himself an outcast in the midst of the populous camp. All the young dogs followed Lip-Lip's lead. There was a difference between White Fang and them. Perhaps they sensed his wild wood breed and instinctively felt for him the enmity that the domestic dog feels for the wolf. But be that as it may, they joined with Lip-Lip in the persecution. And once declared against him, they found good reason to continue declared against him. One and all, from time to time, they felt his teeth. And to his credit, he gave more than he received. Many of them he could whip in a single fight, but single fight was denied him. The beginning of such a fight was a signal for all the young dogs in camp to come running and pitch upon him. Out of this pack persecution, he learned two important things: how to take care of himself in a mass fight against him, and how, on a single dog, to inflict the greatest amount of damage in the briefest space of time. To keep one's feet in the midst of the hostile mass meant life, and this he learned well. He became cat-like in his ability to stay on his feet. Even grown dogs might hurtle him backward or sideways with the impact of their heavy bodies, and backward or sideways he would go, in the air or sliding on the ground, but always with his legs under him and his feet downward to the Mother Earth. When dogs fight, there are usually preliminaries to the actual combat, snarlings and bristlings and stiff-legged struttings. But White Fang learned to omit these preliminaries. Delay meant the coming against him of all the young dogs. He must do his work quickly and get away. So he learned to give no warning of his intention. He rushed in and snapped and slashed on the instant, without notice, before his foe could prepare to meet him. Thus he learned how to inflict quick and severe damage. Also, he learned the value of surprise. A dog, taken off its guard, its shoulder slashed open or its ear ripped in ribbons before it knew what was happening, was a dog half-whipped. Furthermore, it was remarkably easy to overthrow a dog taken by surprise. While a dog, thus overthrown, invariably exposed for a moment the soft underside of its neck, the vulnerable point at which to strike for its life. White Fang knew this point. It was a knowledge bequeathed to him directly from the hunting generations of wolves. So it was that White Fang's method when he took the offensive was, first, to find a young dog alone, second, to surprise it and knock it off its feet, and third, to drive in with his teeth at the soft throat. Being but partly grown, his jaws hadn't yet become large enough nor strong enough to make his throat attack deadly. But many a young dog went around camp with a lacerated throat in token of White Fang's intention. And one day, catching one of his enemies alone on the edge of the woods, he managed, by repeatedly overthrowing him and attacking the throat, to cut the great vein and let out the life. There had been a great row that night. He'd been observed. The news had been carried to the dead dog's master. The squaws remembered all the instances of stolen meat, and Grey Beaver was beset by many angry voices. But he resolutely held the door of his teepee, inside which he had placed the culprit, and refused to permit the vengeance for which his tribespeople clamored. White Fang became hated by man and dog. During this period of his development, he never knew a moment's security. The tooth of every dog was against him, the hand of every man. He was greeted with snarls by his kind, with curses and stones by his gods. He lived tensely. He was always keyed up, alert for attack, wary of being attacked, with an eye for sudden and unexpected missiles, prepared to act precipitately and coolly, to leap in with a flash of teeth or to leap away with a menacing snarl. As for snarling, he could snarl more terribly than any dog, young or old, in camp. The intent of the snarl is to warn or frighten, and judgment is required to know when it should be used. White Fang knew how to make it and when to make it. Into his snarl he incorporated all that was vicious, malignant, and horrible. With nose serrulated by continuous spasms, hair bristling in recurrent waves, tongue whipping out like a red snake and whipping back again, ears flattened down, eyes gleaming hatred, lips wrinkled back, and fangs exposed and dripping, he could compel a pause on the part of almost any assailant. A temporary pause, when taken off his guard, gave him the vital moment in which to think and determine his action. But often a pause so gained lengthened out until it evolved into a complete cessation from the attack. And before more than one of the grown dogs, White Fang's snarl enabled him to beat an honorable retreat. An outcast himself from the pack of the part-grown dogs, his sanguinary methods and remarkable efficiency made the pack pay for its persecution of him. Not permitted himself to run with the pack, the curious state of affairs obtained that no member of the pack could run outside the pack. White Fang wouldn't permit it. What of his bushwhacking and waylaying tactics, the young dogs were afraid to run by themselves. With the exception of Lip-Lip, they were compelled to bunch together for mutual protection against the terrible enemy they had made. A puppy alone by the river bank meant a puppy dead, or a puppy that aroused the camp with its shrill pain and terror as it fled back from the wolf cub that had waylaid it. But White Fang's reprisals didn't cease, even when the young dogs had learned thoroughly that they must stay together. He attacked them when he caught them alone, and they attacked him when they were bunched. The sight of him was sufficient to start them rushing after him, at which times his swiftness usually carried him into safety. But woe to the dog that outran his fellows in such pursuit. White Fang had learned to turn suddenly upon the pursuer that was ahead of the pack, and thoroughly to rip him up before the pack could arrive. This occurred with great frequency, for once in full cry, the dogs were prone to forget themselves in the excitement of the chase, while White Fang never forgot himself. Stealing backward glances as he ran, he was always ready to whirl around and down the overzealous pursuer that outran his fellows. Young dogs are bound to play, and out of the exigencies of the situation, they realized their play in this mimic warfare. Thus it was that the hunt of White Fang became their chief game, a deadly game withal, and at all times a serious game. He, on the other hand, being the fastest-footed, was unafraid to venture anywhere. During the period that he waited vainly for his mother to come back, he led the pack many a wild chase through the adjacent woods. But the pack invariably lost him. Its noise and outcry warned him of its presence, while he ran alone, velvet-footed, silently, a moving shadow among the trees after the manner of his father and mother before him. Further, he was more directly connected with the wild than they, and he knew more of its secrets and stratagems. A favorite trick of his was to lose his trail in running water and then lie quietly in a nearby thicket while their baffled cries arose around him. Hated by his kind and by mankind, indomitable, perpetually warred upon and himself waging perpetual war, his development was rapid and one-sided. This was no soil for kindliness and affection to blossom in. Of such things he hadn't the faintest glimmering. The code he learned was to obey the strong and to oppress the weak. Grey Beaver was a god and strong. Therefore, White Fang obeyed him. But the dog younger or smaller than himself was weak, a thing to be destroyed. His development was in the direction of power. In order to face the constant danger of hurt, and even of destruction, his predatory and protective faculties were unduly developed. He became quicker of movement than the other dogs, swifter of foot, craftier, deadlier, more lithe, more lean with iron-like muscle and sinew, more enduring, more cruel, more ferocious, and more intelligent. He had to become all these things, else he wouldn't have held his own nor survived the hostile environment in which he found himself. Chapter 12. The Trail of the Gods. In the fall of the year, when the days were shortening and the bite of the frost was coming into the air, White Fang got his chance for liberty. For several days there'd been a great hubbub in the village. The summer camp was being dismantled, and the tribe, bag and baggage, was preparing to go off to the fall hunting. White Fang watched it all with eager eyes, and when the teepees began to come down and the canoes were loading at the bank, he understood. Already the canoes were departing, and some had disappeared down the river. quite deliberately, he determined to stay behind. He waited his opportunity to slink out of camp to the woods. Here in the running stream, where ice was beginning to form, he hid his trail. Then he crawled into the heart of a dense thicket and waited. The time passed by, and he slept intermittently for hours. Then he was aroused by Gray Beaver's voice, calling him by name. There were other voices. White Fang could hear Gray Beaver's squaw taking part in the search, and Mitzah, who was Gray Beaver's son. White Fang trembled with fear, and though the impulse came to crawl out of his hiding place, he resisted it. After a time, the voices died away, and some time after that, he crept out to enjoy the success of his undertaking. Darkness was coming on, and for a while he played about among the trees, pleasuring his freedom. Then, and quite suddenly, he became aware of loneliness. He sat down to consider, listening to the silence of the forest and perturbed by it. That nothing moved nor sounded seemed ominous. He felt the lurking of danger, unseen and unguessed. He was suspicious of the looming bulks of the trees and of the dark shadows that might conceal all manner of perilous things. Then it was cold. Here was no warm side of a teepee against which to snuggle. The frost was in his feet, and he kept lifting first one forefoot and then the other. He curved his bushy tail around to cover them, and at the same time he saw a vision. There was nothing strange about it. Upon his inward sight was impressed a succession of memory pictures. He saw the camp again, the teepees, and the blaze of the fires. He heard the shrill voices of the women, the gruff basses of the men, and the snarling of the dogs. He was hungry, and he remembered pieces of meat and fish that had been thrown to him. Here was no meat, nothing but a threatening and inedible silence. His bondage had softened him. Irresponsibility had weakened him. He'd forgotten how to shift for himself. The night yawned about him. His senses, accustomed to the hum and bustle of the camp, used to the continuous impact of sights and sounds, were now left idle. There was nothing to do, nothing to see nor hear. They strained to catch some interruption of the silence and immobility of nature. They were appalled by inaction and by the feel of something terrible impending. He gave a great start of fright. A colossal, formless something was rushing across the field of his vision. It was a tree shadow flung by the moon, from whose face the clouds had been brushed away. Reassured, he whimpered softly. Then he suppressed the whimper, for fear it might attract the attention of the lurking dangers. A tree, contracting in the cool of the night, made a loud noise. It was directly above him. He yelped in his fright. A panic seized him, and he ran madly toward the village. He knew an overpowering desire for the protection and companionship of man. In his nostrils was the smell of the camp smoke. In his ears the camp sounds and cries were ringing loud. He passed out of the forest and into the moonlit open, where were no shadows nor darknesses, but no village greeted his eyes. He'd forgotten. The village had gone away. His wild flight ceased abruptly. There was no place to which to flee. He slunk forlornly through the deserted camp, smelling the rubbish heaps and the discarded rags and tags of the gods. He would have been glad for the rattle of the stones about him flung by an angry squaw, glad for the hand of Gray Beaver descending upon him in wrath, while he would have welcomed with delight Lip-Lip and the whole snarling, cowardly pack. He came to where Gray Beaver's teepee had stood. In the center of the space it had occupied, he sat down. He pointed his nose at the moon. His throat was afflicted with rigid spasms. His mouth opened, and in a heartbroken cry bubbled up his loneliness and fear, his grief for K'iche, all his past sorrows and miseries, as well as his apprehension of sufferings and dangers to come. It was the long wolf howl, full-throated and mournful, the first howl he'd ever uttered. The coming of daylight dispelled his fears, but increased his loneliness. The naked earth, which so shortly before had been so populous, thrust his loneliness more forcibly upon him. It didn't take him long to make up his mind. He plunged into the forest and followed the riverbank down the stream. All day he ran. He didn't rest. He seemed made to run on forever. His iron-like body ignored fatigue. And even after fatigue came, his heritage of endurance braced him to endless endeavor and enabled him to drive his complaining body onward. Where the river swung in against precipitous bluffs, he climbed the high mountains behind. Rivers and streams that entered the main river he forded or swam. Often he took to the rim ice that was beginning to form. And more than once he crashed through and struggled for life in the icy current. Always he was on the lookout for the trail of the gods where it might leave the river and proceed inland. White Fang was intelligent beyond the average of his kind. Yet his mental vision wasn't wide enough to embrace the other bank of the Mackenzie. What if the trail of the gods led out on that side? It never entered his head. Later on, when he'd traveled more and grown older and wiser, and come to know more of trails and rivers, it might be that he could grasp and apprehend such a possibility. But that mental power was yet in the future. Just now, he ran blindly, his own bank of the Mackenzie alone entering into his calculations. All night he ran, blundering in the darkness into mishaps and obstacles that delayed, but didn't daunt. By the middle of the second day, he'd been running continuously for 30 hours, and the iron of his flesh was giving out. It was the endurance of his mind that kept him going. He hadn't eaten in 40 hours, and he was weak with hunger. The repeated drenchings in the icy water had likewise had their effect on him. His handsome coat was draggled. The broad pads of his feet were bruised and bleeding. He'd begun to limp, and this limp increased with the hours. To make it worse, the light of the sky was obscured and snow began to fall. A raw, moist, melting, clinging snow, slippery underfoot, that hid him from the landscape he traversed, and that covered over the inequalities of the ground so that the way of his feet was more difficult and painful. Gray Beaver had intended camping that night on the far bank of the Mackenzie, for it was in that direction that the hunting lay. But on the near bank, shortly before dark, a moose, coming down to drink, had been espied by Klukooch, who was Gray Beaver's squaw. Now, had not the moose come down to drink, and had not Mitzah been steering out of the course because of the snow, and had not Klukooch sighted the moose, and had not Gray Beaver killed it with a lucky shot from his rifle, all subsequent things would have happened differently. Gray Beaver would not have camped on the near side of the Mackenzie, and White Fang would have passed by and gone on, either to die or to find his way to his wild brothers and become one of them, a wolf to the end of his days. Night had fallen. The snow was flying more thickly, and White Fang, whimpering softly to himself as he stumbled and limped along, came upon a fresh trail in the snow. So fresh was it that he knew it immediately for what it was. Whining with eagerness, he followed back from the river bank and in among the trees. The camp sounds came to his ears. He saw the blaze of the fire, Klukooch cooking, and Gray Beaver squatting on his hams and munching a chunk of raw tallow. There was fresh meat in camp. White Fang expected a beating. He crouched and bristled a little at the thought of it. Then he went forward again. He feared and disliked the beating he knew to be waiting for him. But he knew, further, that the comfort of the fire would be his, the protection of the gods, the companionship of the dogs. The last, a companionship of enmity, but nonetheless a companionship, and satisfying to his gregarious needs. He came cringing and crawling into the firelight. Gray Beaver saw him and stopped munching his tallow. White Fang crawled slowly, cringing and groveling in the abjectness of his abasement and submission. He crawled straight toward Gray Beaver, every inch of his progress becoming slower and more painful. At last, he lay at the master's feet, into whose possession he now surrendered himself voluntarily, body and soul. Of his own choice he came in to sit by man's fire and to be ruled by him. White Fang trembled, waiting for the punishment to fall upon him. There was a movement of the hand above him. He cringed involuntarily under the expected blow. It didn't fall. He stole a glance upward. Gray Beaver was breaking the lump of tallow in half. Gray Beaver was offering him one piece of the tallow. Very gently, and somewhat suspiciously, he first smelled the tallow, and then proceeded to eat it. Gray Beaver ordered meat to be brought to him, and guarded him from the other dogs while he ate. After that, grateful and content, White Fang lay at Gray Beaver's feet, gazing at the fire that warmed him, blinking and dozing, secure in the knowledge that the morrow would find him not wandering forlorn through bleak forest stretches, but in the camp of the man-animals, with the gods to whom he'd given himself, and upon whom he was now dependent. Chapter 13. The Covenant. When December was well along, Gray Beaver went on a journey up the Mackenzie. Mitza and Klukooch went with him. One sled he drove himself, drawn by dogs he'd traded for or borrowed. A second and smaller sled was driven by Mitza, and to this was harnessed a team of puppies. It was more of a toy affair than anything else, yet it was the delight of Mitza, who felt that he was beginning to do a man's work in the world. Also, he was learning to drive dogs and to train dogs, while the puppies themselves were being broken into the harness. Furthermore, the sled was of some service, for it carried nearly 200 pounds of outfit and food. White Fang had seen the camp dogs toiling in the harness, so that he didn't resent overmuch the first placing of the harness upon himself. About his neck was put a moss-stuffed collar, which was connected by two pulling traces to a strap that passed around his chest and over his back. It was to this that was fastened the long rope by which he pulled at the sled. There were 7 puppies in the team. The others had been born earlier in the year and were 9 and 10 months old, while White Fang was only 8 months old. Each dog was fastened to the sled by a single rope. No 2 ropes were of the same length, while the difference in length between any 2 ropes was at least that of a dog's body. Every rope was brought to a ring at the front end of the sled. The sled itself was without runners, being a birch-bark toboggan, with upturned forward end to keep it from plowing under the snow. This construction enabled the weight of the sled and load to be distributed over the largest snow surface, for the snow was crystal powder and very soft. Observing the same principle of widest distribution of weight, the dogs at the ends of their ropes radiated fan fashion from the nose of the sled, so that no dog trod in another's footsteps. There was, furthermore, another virtue in the fan formation. The ropes of varying length prevented the dogs attacking from the rear those that ran in front of them. For a dog to attack another, it would have to turn upon one at a shorter rope, in which case it would find itself face to face with the dog attacked, and also it would find itself facing the whip of the driver. But the most peculiar virtue of all lay in the fact that the dog that strove to attack one in front of him must pull the sled faster, and that the faster the sled traveled, the faster could the dog attacked run away. Thus the dog behind could never catch up with the one in front. The faster he ran, the faster ran the one he was after, and the faster ran all the dogs. Incidentally, the sled went faster, and thus, by cunning indiscretion, did man increase his mastery over the beasts. Mitzah resembled his father, much of whose gray wisdom he possessed. In the past, he'd observed Lip Lip's persecution of White Fang. But at the time, Lip Lip was another man's dog, and Mitzah never dared more than to shy an occasional stone at him. But now, Lip Lip was his dog, and he proceeded to wreak his vengeance upon him by putting him at the end of the longest rope. This made Lip Lip the leader, and was apparently an honor. But in reality, it took away from him all honor, and instead of being bully and master of the pack, he now found himself hated and persecuted by the pack. Because he ran at the end of the longest rope, the dogs had always the view of him running away before them. All that they saw of him was his bushy tail and fleeing hind legs, a view far less ferocious and intimidating than his bristling mane and gleaming fangs. Also, dogs being so constituted in their mental ways, the sight of him running away gave desire to run after him, and a feeling that he ran away from them. The moment the sled started, the team took after Lip Lip in a chase that extended throughout the day. At first he'd been prone to turn upon his pursuers, jealous of his dignity and wrathful. But at such times Mitzah would throw the stinging lash of the 30-foot caribou gut whip into his face and compel him to turn tail and run on. Lip Lip might face the pack, but he couldn't face that whip, and all that was left him to do was to keep his long rope taut and his flanks ahead of the teeth of his mates. But a still greater cunning lurked in the recesses of the Indian mind. To give point to unending pursuit of the leader, Mitza favored him over the other dogs. These favors aroused in them jealousy and hatred. In their presence, Mitza would give him meat and would give it to him only. This was maddening to them. They would rage around just outside the throwing distance of the whip, while Lip-Lip devoured the meat and Mitza protected him. And when there was no meat to give, Mitza would keep the team at a distance and make believe to give meat to Lip-Lip. White Fang took kindly to the work. He'd traveled a greater distance than the other dogs in the yielding of himself to the rule of the gods, and he'd learned more thoroughly the futility of opposing their will. In addition, the persecution he'd suffered from the pack had made the pack less to him in the scheme of things, and man more. He'd not learned to be dependent on his kind for companionship. Besides, K'iche was well nigh forgotten, and the chief outlet of expression that remained to him was in the allegiance he tendered the gods he'd accepted as masters. So he worked hard, learned discipline, and was obedient. Faithfulness and willingness characterized his toil. These are essential traits of the wolf and the wild dog when they become domesticated, and these traits White Fang possessed in unusual measure. A companionship did exist between White Fang and the other dogs, but it was one of warfare and enmity. He'd never learned to play with them. He knew only how to fight, and fight with them he did, returning to give them 100-fold the snaps and slashes they'd given him in the days when Lip-Lip was leader of the pack. But Lip-Lip was no longer leader, except when he fled away before his mates at the end of his rope, the sled bounding along behind. In camp, he kept close to Mitza or Grey Beaver or Klu-Kooch. He didn't dare venture away from the gods, for now the fangs of all dogs were against him, and he tasted to the dregs the persecution that had been White Fang's. With the overthrow of Lip-Lip, White Fang could have become the leader of the pack, but he was too morose and solitary for that. He merely thrashed his teammates. Otherwise, he ignored them. They got out of his way when he came along, nor did the boldest of them ever dare to rob him of his meat. On the contrary, they devoured their own meat hurriedly, for fear that he would take it away from them. White Fang knew the law well. To oppress the weak and obey the strong. He ate his share of meat as rapidly as he could. And then woe the dog that had not yet finished. A snarl and a flash of fangs, and that dog would wail his indignation to the uncomforting stars while White Fang finished his portion for him. Every little while, however, one dog or another would flame up in revolt and be promptly subdued. Thus, White Fang was kept in training. He was jealous of the isolation in which he kept himself in the midst of the pack, and he fought often to maintain it. But such fights were of brief duration. He was too quick for the others. They were slashed open and bleeding before they knew what had happened, were whipped almost before they'd begun to fight. As rigid as the sled discipline of the gods was the discipline maintained by White Fang amongst his fellows. He never allowed them any latitude. He compelled them to an unremitting respect for him. They might do as they pleased amongst themselves. That was no concern of his. But it was his concern that they leave him alone in his isolation, get out of his way when he elected to walk among them, and at all times acknowledge his mastery over them. A hint of stiff-leggedness on their part, a lifted lip or a bristle of hair, and he would be upon them, merciless and cruel, swiftly convincing them of the error of their way. He was a monstrous tyrant. His mastery was rigid as steel. He oppressed the weak with a vengeance. Not for nothing had he been exposed to the pitiless struggle for life in the days of his cubhood, when his mother and he, alone and unaided, held their own and survived in the ferocious environment of the wild. And not for nothing had he learned to walk softly when superior strength went by. He oppressed the weak, but he respected the strong. And in the course of the long journey with Grey Beaver, he walked softly indeed amongst the full-grown dogs in the camps of the strange man-animals they encountered. The months passed by. Still continued the journey of Grey Beaver. White Fang's strength was developed by the long hours on the trail and the steady toil at the sled. And it would have seemed that his mental development was well nigh complete. He had come to know quite thoroughly the world in which he lived. His outlook was bleak and materialistic. The world, as he saw it, was a fierce and brutal world, a world without warmth, a world in which caresses and affection and the bright sweetness of the spirit did not exist. He had no affection for Grey Beaver. True, he was a god, but a most savage god. White Fang was glad to acknowledge his lordship. But it was a lordship based upon superior intelligence and brute strength. There was something in the fiber of White Fang's being that made this lordship a thing to be desired. Else he would not have come back from the wild when he did, to tender his allegiance. There were deeps in his nature which had never been sounded. A kind word, a caressing touch of the hand on the part of Grey Beaver might have sounded these deeps. But Grey Beaver didn't caress nor speak kind words. It wasn't his way. His primacy was savage. And savagely he ruled, administering justice with a club, punishing transgression with the pain of a blow, and rewarding merit not by kindness, but by withholding a blow. So White Fang knew nothing of the heaven a man's hand might contain for him. Besides, he didn't like the hands of the man-animals. He was suspicious of them. It was true that they sometimes gave meat, but more often they gave hurt. Hands were things to keep away from. They hurled stones, wielded sticks and clubs and whips, administered slaps and clouts, and when they touched him, were cunning to hurt with pinch and twist and wrench. In strange villages he had encountered the hands of the children and learned that they were cruel to hurt. Also, he'd once nearly had an eye poked out by a toddling papoose. From these experiences he became suspicious of all children. He couldn't tolerate them. When they came near with their ominous hands, he got up.
This ends Disc 4.